Are you tired? Are you frequently in a state of fatigue? It might surprise you to learn that your cellular health begins to decline as early as 25 years of age. As you age, your cell membranes start to become like Swiss cheese. This cellular damage is the primary cause of biological aging. It could be the root of your fatigue. But there's a breakthrough supplement that's scientifically proven to repair and renew your body's cells. NT-Factor Lipids. NT-Factor lipids are identical to the phospholipids found in your cellular membranes. NT-Factor is the only solution proven and published in medical journals to repair those dead spots in the membranes. If you're older, it can give you back the vitality, focus, and cognitive function of people half your age. And if you're young, this is the tool to optimize your energy production. I've been using NT-Factor for years and prescribe it for my patients. Learn more about the NT-Factor line of nutritional formulas at your favorite health food store or online retailer, or to order direct, call 800-982-9158, 800-982-9158, or go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. As you know, I've been writing about the Eat Lancet program where back in 2019, if you recall, the prestigious international medical journal Lancet issued a call for curbing meat consumption. And the Eat Lancet Commission invoked the alleged health benefits of reducing intake of animal protein and claimed also, somewhat ambitiously, that plant-based eating could also help save the planet. The food industry and agribusiness piled on and applauded it as it contemplated market opportunities for novel plant-based meat substitutes. And so there's been a great convergence of powerful interests: big food, big pharma, big medicine, big media, big science, big agriculture, big finance. They're all coalescing around the proposition that a plant-based diet is the salvation of humanity, that it'll prevent disease at the same time saving the planet from climate calamity. So into the fray comes today's guest. She is Jane Buxton. I'm talking to Jane over there in the UK. She's UK-based, so through the miracles of modern technology, we're recording this podcast. Jane is an investigative writer, and she's written a great book entitled The Great Plant-Based Con: Why Eating a Plants-Only Diet Won't Improve Your Health or Save the Planet. It's an amazing work because she's armed with 1,463 references and nearly 500 pages of very, very detailed text. And so I want to welcome Jane to the program. Thanks for joining us, Jane. Where are you located tonight?
Thank you for having me. I am in London, in Wimbledon, actually.
Indeed.
Southwest of London.
Yeah. All right. And so we got about a 5-6 hour time difference. And thanks for joining us from over there, but you sound crystal clear. Jane, what prompted you to do the investigation behind the great plant-based con?
Well, you had mentioned one of the prompts, actually, when you mentioned this Eat Lancet study, because it was in 2019 that I became extremely acutely aware of the uptick in plant-based messaging and the fact that message you talk about plant-based will save your health, save the planet, was becoming ubiquitous. And Eat Lancet was one place it was coming from, and it received an enormous amount of attention, that report and that planetary diet. The other thing that received a lot of attention at the same time was a movie called The Game Changers, which you probably know. And both of those things really, I think, intensified that messaging. And I was very aware at the time that much of the messaging was supported by facts, I'll call them facts that were different to the facts that I understood. And so that tipped me off to the fact that there was quite a lot of misinformation infecting the debate, and I wanted to unearth that. And so I decided to punch hole, you know, headlong into a proper vote.
Okay. And your book, it seems to be divided into four basic parts. The first part asks the question, are plant-based diets better for your health? And the second part addresses, will plant-based diets save the planet? Are they beneficial for global warming, climate change, what have you? The third is a kind of a deep dive on the forces behind advocacy for a plant-based diet. And they're somewhat insidious, according to your analysis. And finally, you offer recommendations on how we should eat that are science-based and also based on principles of sound agriculture. So let's start with this concept, because they're trying to hook the two concepts together. They're trying to say, look, plant-based diets are better for us health-wise, and oh, by the way, you can attain virtue by doing your part to save the planet. So how can you lose with that proposition?
Well, how can you? Exactly. It's a wonderful thing. I think that the doubling up of the argument, so attaching the health arguments to the environmental arguments, gives advocates a kind of really handy double-handed trick, which we, you know, when I used to work in business, we used to call it the assumptive close. So what it to do is to say, even if you're not totally on board with the fact that it might be better for your health, oh, but we were, you know, it's better for the environment, so we may as well. And then the reverse is true. So it creates this really tight, locked-in argument, which I picked, and that what I set out to do was to unpick those, unhook them.
Indeed. So, you know, in a detailed analysis, I have here in front of me something that just came across the wires, but it's not new. The headline here is, red meat is not a health risk. New study slams years of shoddy research, and I think you keep up with things, so you're aware that the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation has done a very, very extensive review. They've scrutinized decades of research on red meat consumption, and its links to various health outcomes. And their findings mostly dispel any concerns about eating red meat. They did not find linkages to the major diseases, cancer, cardiovascular disease, and so on.
And it's not surprising that that's what they find, because there have been previous studies that have found the same thing. So the most impressive and kind of influential one also came out in 2019. A lot happened in 2019. And that was the Annals of Internal Medicine, five papers, which dispelled those links between red meat and disease. And there have been subsequent ones as well. And it isn't surprising to me that we keep discovering this, because all of the original research that purported to show the links between meat and disease were mostly epidemiological in nature, mostly with very low risk factors. Mostly beset by all of the things that do beset epidemiology in the field of nutrition, such mm-hmm. as being based on food frequency questionnaires, which are often extremely inaccurate. So, and then you have the confounding variables, and all of those mean that really any findings that have been reported should be taken with a great big pinch of salt. And I think that's what this study that you're talking about is saying.
And it appears that the final coffin nail in the Eat Lancet health proposition comes to us from a study that just came out this month in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And, you know, I avidly read that journal. Mm-hmm. And I open it up with great excitement to see an article entitled Association Between Adherence to the Eat Lancet Diet and Risk of Cancer and Cardiovascular Outcomes in something called the Nutrinet Santé Cohort, which is a study out of France.
Yeah.
And the authors somewhat disappointedly report, contrary to our hypothesis, I guess they thought that they would see major improvements in the health of people when they follow this very low meat regime. They say, contrary to our hypothesis, our results documented significant association between adherence to the Eat Lancet diet and the incidence of cancer only in some subgroups and no, and I repeat, no association with cardiovascular disease. They were bummed.
They were. And those subgroups were beset, if I recall that study, they were beset by other health issues. So the confounding factors of what were driving the disease in those people, they were obese or they had diabetes or otherwise were unhealthy people. Mm-hmm. So, I think that's a fascinating study. And again, I'm not surprised. The author might have been surprised, but those of us who looked at Eat Lancet's diet when it came out are not surprised. It's well known that it's been critiqued on the level of nutrition because it is failing in a number of angles and on a number of nutrients. But it's also, even by Eat Lancet, even by their own admission, it's not a diet that's suitable for, I think they list, children, babies, teenagers, pregnant women, older people, frail people, sick people. You know, so there's this very tight group of people in the middle who they say should be eating this diet and can healthily do so. But the fact that it has all of these restrictions for these other groups in the population should have set alarm bells ringing anyway, initially.
And when there are studies that suggest that meat is bad for you, that meat is associated with cancer risks, is associated with even some studies that show that meat is associated with diabetes, even when we know that very low-carb diets that are actually meat-centric can be helpful for diabetes. When you mention the word confounding, what are you talking about there? And how does confounding distort some of these observational and epidemiological studies?
So, yeah, but a simplest way to put it, what we generally see is that when people say, for instance, that a plant-based diet is relatively better for health, and they're able to prove to show those associations, it's very likely that the individuals who are eating that plant-based diet are also following other healthful behaviors, and so that will improve the result for the diet, when in fact it may be the fact that they exercised more, they smoked less, or they were thin, you know, they didn't have visceral body fat. So all of those will pollute or confound the results. And the same is true when you get associations between meat eating and disease. It's not necessarily the meat that's going to be causing that disease. It could be high levels of carbohydrate and fried food consumption, the stuff that surrounds the meat. It could be that those people are generally prone to more unhealthy behaviors because historically, eating less meat has been linked with healthy behaviors. So there's all that bias which infects the results.
And very few of these studies distinguish between processed meat and unprocessed meat. So the people who are eating sausage, or what you folks across the pond would refer to as bangers. you know, the very, you know, highly processed meat with lots of additives, poor quality meat, meat that is basically derived from corn-fed sources, which is not rich in omega-3 fatty acids, that may be part of it. But then there are actually some studies that relatively vindicate even processed meat lately.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was a review by Maria Guashfere, and I'm sure I mispronounced her name, but one of the lead authors, who said that most of the studies that did find these links between processed meat and disease were beset by all of these confounding factors, very weak methodologies, very inconsistent publication bias, you know, the full range of weaknesses right. you find in a study. And we have to remember that the big study that really sought to establish the link between processed meat and cancer was the WHO study from 2015. And even that study couldn't find very much of the link. So it was a really small risk factor of about 0.18%, I think it was, which really is, if you look at that in terms of actual risk, so absolute risk, you find that your overall risk, say, of getting colon cancer might be 5.6% as an ordinary human being. Eating an extra 5 slices of bacon every day for your entire life will raise that ostensibly to 6.6%. It's a really tiny, tiny risk increase, but it's blown up and called a 20% risk increase. And the media picks up on this, and that's how we end up where we are today.
And it might be that 999 people would have to avoid eating bacon so that one person might avoid the risk of colon cancer, or maybe
that's
even
right.
The numbers might be even more astronomical than that.
Yeah.
There's lots of detail in the book on the health argument that goes against the grain, or goes against the Eat Lancet plant-based concept. But let's switch gears and let's look at the environmental consequences, because they're making a lot of that these days. They're calling for lower methane emissions. We know that cows' eructations, it's actually not cow flatulence that releases methane into the world, but that is causing a greenhouse effect, and also animal-based agriculture is very high on the food chain, very energy intensive, very water intensive, and therefore we should be eating more vegetables. And the Eat Lancet report actually calls for, I think it's 7 grams of animal protein per day. It's just 7 grams. Mm-hmm. People, over there in the UK, people know grams, but 7 grams is about what you could hold in the palm of your hand.
Yeah. So they're calling for that primarily on the basis of it, of its impact on the environment. And what you'll notice is most of the studies that try to demonstrate that animal foods are very bad for the environment always do that relative to, say, calories or kilos of product or whatever. So it makes animal source foods and meat in particular look very, very bad. What is rarely done is to look at the emissions per quality of protein, per grams of bioavailable full complete protein, for instance, or per a range of nutrients. And when you do that, when you start to compare emissions to nutrient quality, you start to get a very, very different picture. And, there are lots of other ways that the methane impact has been exaggerated. I'm not saying that livestock doesn't have some impact. All foods have some impact. Every single thing we do in life has some impact on the environment and creates emissions. But the emissions associated with livestock have been exaggerated on a number of fronts. For one thing, they're calculated based on a metric called GWP 100, which many scientists now, including some from the LEAP University at Oxford University here, believe should be replaced by GWP star. They believe that because the current warming effect of livestock is being exaggerated by 3 to 4 times by this GWP 100. It's not scientifically accurate to reflect the real impact of methane from cows in a ecological farm setting. And there are other ways that the exaggeration takes place. Nobody accounts for the sequestration that happens when we can draw down carbon from the sky by use of managed grazing, properly managed grazing. And there's also this tendency to use the global number to apply to places like the United States or the United Kingdom, when actually the cattle that are raised in those places bear no resemblance to the cattle being raised in some other parts of the world. So as you probably know, the emissions numbers might be 14.5% is the official number from the FAO for global picture. But, for cattle in the States, it's 2% of emission. Sure. Here in the UK, it's about 5.8%. And that's before you account for all the other sequestration effects. So there are so many ways that it's blown out of proportion, and that's doing a lot of harm to the debate.
Is it reasonable to expect that if we went with these recommendations, that it would make have a big impact on the rising sea levels, on the increasing temperatures, or is that just a mere fraction, small fraction of what pollutants and carbon release and methane release from industrial processes is doing to our climate?
It is. You're correct. I think it's a small fraction of it. I liken it to rearranging the deck chairs. Really, I don't think it's going to impact the climate in any really significant way. It may do initially, but a leading climate scientist here, Professor Miles Allen, has also warned us that if we were to eradicate the methane from all livestock, we would impact global temperatures by a small amount, some percentages of degrees over the next 10 years. But he said, if we don't get to grips with the other causes, the fossil fuel-driven climate change, pretty much nothing else matters. And he has said that everything else is irrelevant. So, yeah, we need to be focusing on the right things. And I think that livestock becomes a distraction from focusing on the right things.
And aren't there ways to mitigate the methane release from these farm animals? Because it's thought that one of the reasons for methane emission, to put it delicately, from these animals is because they're fed unnatural feeds, that if they were actually pastured and raised on grass, as is natural, that this would literally change the composition of the cowburbs.
Well, I don't know if it's so much that the actual cowburbs themselves would change. There are other things that change that, such as if you know, it's being experimented with including seaweed in mm-hmm. feed.
Yeah. I've heard that.
You reduce it by 10-20%. So that on that front, yes, you can change the actual emission of the methane. But the other thing that happens really when you put cows onto pasture and you manage them holistically and in what's called the, you know, holistic planned grazing, mob grazing, whatever the term is that you want to use, if you're managing them, you are drawing down that methane in the form of carbon into the soil. So you're extracting the carbon or you're enabling, to be more accurate, you're enabling the soil to be better at extracting that carbon. So it's creating a more circular, virtuous cycle, as it were, by managing the cattle properly.
Okay. So those are the first two contentions behind the effort to literally mandate a plant-based diet, because there are many forces aligned to do this. So, you know, not just consumer appeal, you know, buy this Impossible Burger, but there's actually regulations, subsidies, mandates, pressures that will coalesce to push this agenda. And in part two, I want to take a look at who's behind this. And you've done some great investigative writing on that subject in your book, The Great Plant-Based Con, Why Eating a Plants-Only Diet Won't Improve Your Health or Save the Planet. We often ask the question, if I get the Latin right, qui bono, who benefits, right? I don't know if that's correct pronunciation, but, who's behind this? And we're going to take a look at that, pull the curtain back a little bit, as you did in your book. Our guest is Jane Buxton, author of The Great Plant-Based Con. Jane, is there a website also where we can find out about your book?
Yep, there's my name, Jane Rhys Buxton, www.janereysbuxton.com, or you can just type in the name of the book, and that's also linked to the website.
So, okay, for our spell-challenged individuals, it's Buxton, and it's Jane, Jayne, correct?
That's right.
All right. Thank you. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We'll be right back with part two of today's podcast. This is Intelligent Medicine.